Welcome to all who are here to Kieran Wilson's second talk on the Micah Kingdom Prophecies. To open, read Micah chapter 4, and we'll commence at verse 6 through to the end of Micah chapter 5.
Thanks for that, and thank you for that reading as well at such late notice. And welcome everyone to those who are here. There's more people here than what I thought there were going to be, but that's great. Those who are at home as well, which includes my wife, hello, and the two rabbits as well, who I'm sure are watching very keenly. So I mentioned at the very end of our last class that it only gets better, because our last class has sort of started off a little bit rough. We're looking at judgments, and then started getting into some good things, started looking at the kingdom prophecies, and it really just picks up. There are some interesting verses here that we'll look at that don't look positive maybe at the outset, but they're really positive. They're really amazing. So let's jump straight into it. And by jump straight into it, I mean we'll look back at what we did last week. So just as a bit of a recap for those who weren't here, and if you were here, maybe to jog your memory a little bit, we looked at some examples of what not to do. That was primarily chapter 3, listed a whole heap of, graphic descriptions of things that we shouldn't be doing and what happens when you do them. And then I had this pretty awesome quote there: with great power comes great responsibility. I said that was from Spider-Man. Other people said that that was from Voltaire. So I wanted to prove some people wrong and did a bit of research, and I found out it's actually a Bible verse, which I wasn't aware of. So it's from Luke 12, verse 48, a rough version anyway. And that says, "Everyone to whom much is given, of him much will be required. And from him to whom they entrusted much, they will demand the more." So it's, the modern day version of what Luke is saying there. We talked about the consequences of sin as well. Again, fairly graphic examples that were given there. Obviously, it's metaphorical for us, but it still impacts us a lot. And we still need to be wary and take steps to eliminate this sin so that we don't invite it into our own places, like what Hezekiah did with the Babylonian envoys. And we saw that the victory far outweighs anything that the world can offer us right now, which is absolutely amazing to look at. Just to provide some clarification as well, I was slightly wrong with something that I mentioned last week. So when we're talking about the kingdom visions, and I sort of talked about sitting underneath the shade of a tree and I'll be able to put my feet up, that's more for the general population who survive. They'll be able to relax, they'll have that safety. We'll, of course, be doing work, teaching, building, doing whatever that God wants us to do. So I think most of my other points stand up, but I wanted to just clarify that I was slightly wrong there. But let's dive into it. I tried to come up with a better heading up the top there, but that's what my Bible starts off with, this section, and I thought that basically sums it all up. The Lord shall rescue Zion. So in carrying on with our look, we start at verse 6, in that day. Starts off with those three words again. If we glance back to the beginning of the chapter, it's the same time frame. So verse 1 mentions, it shall come to pass in the latter days. Here it's in that day. Has basically the same means. And we know from last class, we know from other times, that that's referencing our time here. We live in the last days. And again, as I said last class, this should make us sort of concentrate a little bit more. Maybe sit up a little bit straighter and go, hey, what's being said about is speaking directly to me. It's not something that was going to happen hundreds or thousands of years in the future from now. It's something that's right around the corner, potentially a day, couple of days, week, month from where we are. So what's going to happen in those last latter days? God's going to bring together those who are deemed by the world to be weak, those who've been rejected. He's going to bring together the weak and rejected. Usually this isn't something people celebrate. We don't rock up to work and go, hey, yeah, I'm awesome, I'm weak. It's not something that we think of. And especially when we discussed last class about the greed and the power that happens in the world, I think it's almost a blessing in disguise. So I wanted to look at this just for a little bit, maybe for some of the younger people who might be a little bit confused with why it's good to be weak, but I guess for everyone, just to give a good reminder of when it's okay to be what the world considers to be weak or broken or lame. So Paul basically opens up his first letter in Corinthians saying much the same sort of thing. It's a whole massive slab of text there. I've picked out three verses that I think roughly sum it up. But if we're in Corinthians, we could go back to verse 18 and go right the way through to the end. So I'll just read this little verse here. You can read on the screen as well. "For consider your calling, brothers, not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are." And I've got just sort of highlighted there just to make it clearer of what's going on. And we can see there in bold as well, it's God chose. God's making this distinction. He's wanting to call those people out. First of all, I want to emphasize the little point. This does work. It says not many of you. Obviously, Paul would have been speaking to people who that would have applied to. They perhaps would have been powerful and wise in that world. But I'll use myself as an example here so I don't throw anyone else under the bus. I'm not wise according to worldly standards. I'd like to think I'm above average smart, perhaps, maybe just slightly above, depending on who you ask. But certainly not wise. I'm not powerful. I'm not of noble birth. In fact, through my grandma, she'll love this story. Through my grandma, I can trace our ancestry back to the First Fleet. So that's definitely not noble there. That's probably the opposite of noble. Instead, as I mentioned, God chose. Multiple times in these verses, he said, God chose. And it goes to show that God has called every one of us regardless of our positioning within the world. We don't have to be super smart to be a follower of Christ. We can be anyone. And I think this would have resonated well with the people that Micah originally spoke to, perhaps. Those farmers, those country people who were just the Joe average of the world. So a classic example of this is David. Just a shepherd boy who strode out to fight Goliath. I love this story. I loved it when I was a kid because, I mean, let's face it, it was a battle. It was interesting. It was exciting. And now I love it because it shows the true power of God. It shows that God can use small things or small people to do incredible things. We know the story, so I'm not going to go through it all. David's wearing just his shepherding clothes. He's a sling and a staff in the hand. He picks up just five little stones. He comes face to face, or probably would have been face to stomach, with Goliath, absolutely mountainous man, decked out in all the armour a soldier could possibly want. Humanly speaking, no one would expect David to do anything. These little stones would usually probably bounce off and David would be gone. Yet just minutes later, Goliath is the one that's on the ground dead. It wasn't through pure skill or talent or strength that David won. It was God who had that victory. It was God who guided that stone into Goliath's forehead. That's the weak and the foolish overcoming the strong and the wise. So I think that's pretty powerful. And we'll see a couple of times this idea of it's God's victory, not our own victory, it's God's. So if we bring our minds back to Micah 4, God's going to bring the lame. He's going to bring those that have been driven away, those who have been afflicted, and make them into a strong nation, reigning over them forever. Again, we have partial fulfillments of that have already happened. God brought the Jews back into the land not that long ago, after they were driven out by the Romans, thousands of years ago. They were afflicted wherever they went. Terrible things have happened to them, basically all throughout history. But they've finally been brought back into the land that was promised. And nowadays, they're even a relatively strong nation, although they still need to submit to God's rulership, and that's something that they don't do now. But that day's coming when God is going to reign over them forever. So before we jump down to the next section, If we look, I'll just get turned to the right page, look at verse 8. Verse 8 to me is absolutely amazing. Says there in Micah 4, "And you, O tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you shall it come. The former dominion shall come, kingship, for the daughter of Jerusalem." This is our first, well, not first hint, sorry, but a hint at Jesus. Jesus is coming. Jesus is going to be this king. And we see this awesome, I think it's awesome anyway. We've got the tower of the flock, bringing out these aspects of the shepherd there, as well as being the king. And these are things that we'll talk about later on in chapter 5. So I think it's really awesome, this similar sort of language always being used. So we'll come a bit more to that later. If we jump down to verse 11, we have this awesome prophecy here. Again, it's one that's already kind of partially being fulfilled, but it will be completely fulfilled when Christ returns and Christ establishes the kingdom. So if we look for verse 11 to 13, I'll just read that quickly. "Now many nations are assembled against you, saying, 'Let her be defiled, and let our eyes gaze upon Zion.' But they do not know the thoughts of the Lord. They do not understand his plan, as he has gathered them as sheaves on the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make your horn iron, and I will make your hooves bronze. I will beat in pieces, many peoples, and shall devote their gain to the Lord, their wealth to the Lord of the whole earth." Pretty awesome, I think. So what are some points that we get here? Many nations is really an understatement there. And that's only if we look purely at the nations as a whole that want Israel gone. It is many, many nations. They're absolutely surrounded. Israel is surrounded now, just as they always have been. It might not be literal neighbours, but if we look at the general vicinity of Israel right now, there's definitely more enemies than there are friends. I thought this was, I didn't realise it was this many nations that were just locally around, but if we look at what's on the screen, Israel don't have relations with 17 of 21 UN members who are in the Arab League. That's pretty high. They don't have any relations with another 10 members of the Organisation of Islamic Cooperation. And if we look at this picture here, those that are green, they're people that are they're generally pretty peaceful, have good relations. There's only two of those. Look around all the red that really don't like Israel. They have no relations at all. Even if we look at the blue, they only have limited. That, to me, is Israel being surrounded. So we can already see perhaps some of the pieces falling into place here. Even if we go back to when Israel was established as a country in 1948, there have been numerous attacks on Israel by the surrounding Arab nations. All of those have been driven off, not through Israel's sheer power, but through God. If we put this prophecy into context, it's of course speaking about a future time. Israel's enemies haven't known the thoughts of God and have been destroyed, and that's going to happen again. In the future, there's going to be that coming battle that hasn't happened yet, where many nations will be gathered together, and ultimately it's going to be God's victory. Just as when it was God's victory when he pushed those Assyrians back all those many years ago, which was foretold as well. Through this victory, God will give those in Israel strength. God will cause them to break in pieces many people, as verse 13 tells us. And if we use the imagery here of the threshing floor, like it mentions, they're going to absolutely crush and trample over these people, like an ox would to wheat. Again, not through Israel's strength, but through God's. So if we look at chapter 5, to me, I see this more of a bridging verse, I guess. Absolutely amazing verse. But it links these two couple of chapters very nicely together. One's talking about the kingdom being established and God's victory. The other one's talking about this coming king. obviously they're both related. You can't have a kingdom without a king, otherwise you've just got a dom, and that doesn't work. So they're both very tied in with this. Coincidentally enough, the Hebrew Bible actually includes this first verse in with Micah 4. So again, showing how interrelated it is, using similar words we see in chapter 4. We jumped over a couple of these verses, but in verses 8 and 9 and 10, we have this idea of a city under siege, a people crying out for a king. Is there no king in you? Has your counselor perished? We also see as well in verse 1, we have a perfect symmetry of what's going to happen in the future. And this will help set the scene with Christ now coming onto the scene in Micah. So I've got that verse up there because to me this is just incredible foreshadowing. Verse 1 mentions halfway through, with a rod they strike the judge of Israel on the cheek. And then Luke here specifically, Luke mentions that the Pharisees and the Jews struck Jesus. We're not necessarily told here where they hit him. I'd be willing to bet that there's probably going to be more than a few hits to the head. That's striking the cheek. So just some amazing foreshadowing that goes on into something that is kind of small, kind of insignificant. They wouldn't have known about it. They would have just thought, hey, I'm hitting Jesus, that's all fine. Jesus would have known. So they beat him and struck you and said, who's striking you? We then come to verse 2, which Ralph didn't spoil, but gave away part of what I was going to talk about. One of the probably more well-known verses in Micah, even among non-religious people. It's of course speaking about the birth of Christ, that ruler born to lead Israel and foretold from long ago. So we don't need to necessarily look at verses that speak of Christ's birth. If we did, we would be here for at least a few hours. But just a couple of points that we get out from this. We've got there that Bethlehem, and I've put birthplace of great kings, because that's where David was born as well. And it's through David's line that we have that kingly line that Jesus was a part of as well. So we know obviously David was a great king. He wasn't always righteous, but he was a man after God's own heart. And later to come, an even greater king, the greatest who's ever going to rule, is going to be born there as well. It's to a little town from a little tribe, and yet it's going to have the greatest honour of being the birthplace of Christ. And we also know that Jews knew about this when Jesus was born as well. Herod called in the chief priests and the scribes, and they knew about this prophecy because they told him it, which kind of makes it a little bit sadder that it is those chief priests and scribes who remembered this verse, who knew that it was foretold, and yet 33 years later they would be screaming for their Messiah's death. Absolutely staggering turnaround. They knew it, and yet they still put him to death. We've seen that the lineage here still remains from David and even goes beyond that to look at some of the promises made to Abraham. We're told that it's from old and of ancient days. It survived exile. It survived all the death and destruction that came upon Israel. It even survived the times of the kings when coups were happening. And not that I've been through a coup or anything, but generally you get rid of people who have a potential claim to the throne. Anyone in David's line would have had that potential claim. So we saw, for instance, when Queen Athaliah came to power, she wiped out everyone except one person who had a claim to the throne, and that was through David. If she had killed everyone, we wouldn't have this line. Everyone but Joash. He's not mentioned in Luke or Matthew's genealogies, but he still is a part of it. So I think that's just absolutely staggering. Perhaps something that we might overthink a little bit is that this line continued right through history. But Jesus isn't going to be ruling immediately. God's going to give up Israel with no king in place. Israel are going to be ruled over by others. until the rest of his brothers will return to the people of Israel. So we touched on this a little bit earlier. We have seen the return of Israel back into the land, but it's still not completely full of Jews. There's still a large population living out there. Whether they have to come back or not remains to be seen. But when that time eventually does come, Jesus is going to stand and he's going to protect his people. Like a shepherd, it says again, bringing in those ideas from chapter 4. And it shows to me at least that the sharp contrast, we've got Jesus here as a shepherd, and we had the rulers, the current rulers in Micah's time, who were like butchers. Night and day is the difference that it's going to be. Jesus is going to rule with the strength and the majesty of God. And because of this, as I was alluded to earlier in chapter 4 that we looked at last class, there's going to be absolute peace and they'll dwell securely. That's going to be an incredible time, not only for us, but specifically for Jerusalem as just a city. There's a book from Eric Klein called Jerusalem Besieged, and he counted up that Jerusalem has been destroyed at least 2 times. It's been besieged 23 times. It's been attacked an additional 52 times. And it's been captured and recaptured 44 times. I don't think there's ever been a city that has had that much turmoil, that much destruction, the complete opposite of peace. And yet when Jesus returns, there's just going to be peace. It's finally going to live up to that name, which I think is absolutely staggering. As we jump down, we get to verse 5. And it's basically this deliverance from Gentile invaders. If we look at verse 5, it says, the first part there, "And he shall be their peace," referring more to verse 4. "When the Assyrian comes into our land and treads in our palaces, then we will rise against him, or raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men. They shall shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod at its entrances. And he shall deliver us from the Assyrian when he comes into our land and treads within our border." So we're going to have the Assyrian invasion is going to be thwarted, and this righteous ruler, along with some shepherds and some princes, they're going to defeat Assyria, they're going to defeat Babylon as well. The numbers here are more symbolic, so don't necessarily try and factor in maybe anything too crazy. It is more the symbolism there. There's already been, as we've seen with a lot of these prophecies, already been some fulfillment that's gone on. We see that God did save Israel from Assyria, but Babylon, or Nimrod as it's put here, defeats Israel, and we know that they take him into captivity, but only for a little while. In the future, though, with Jesus as ruler, Assyria and Babylon are going to be put in their place, and that's under the feet of Jesus. So, obviously, Babylon and Assyria... Thank you, Siri. Obviously, Babylon and Assyria, they're not places that live. Okay, when Babylon and that place... They obviously don't exist anymore. And the places that they once called home are made up of several different countries. But for us in prophecy, Babylon and to a lesser extent Assyria, I said it didn't go off, that's good, represents just general Gentile opposition against God and against Israel. And we know that Babylon's mentioned along with Rome as being in opposition to God throughout Revelation. And it's the same here in these verses here. They're just in general defiance. And it's just the general Gentiles. As we keep reading, we get to this little section in verses 7 and 8 that, I'll be honest, I didn't understand. Now, perhaps it's initially, sorry, I understand it now. Perhaps it's because I'm not really great with poetry or symbolism or metaphors or anything. Tiff would be nodding her head vigorously. But I sort of didn't understand it to start with. I had to look at it, reread it, and now it just looks absolutely amazing. So we see this first part in verse 7. So we have this remnant of Jacob is going to be in the midst of many people. That part's repeated. That part's the same in those two verses. Verse 7, it's like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass, which delay not for a man, nor wait for the children of men. So what's this talking about? Rain and dew are good things. We have the rain, it freshens up the earth. You know, through summer our gardens might start looking pretty terrible, pretty dry. All of a sudden that first rain comes through and things start looking green. Rain helps make things grow, helps sustain us, and dew does much the same. So that's what part of a scenario is going to look at. They're going to be among the people and they're going to be teaching them and helping them. So if we look just a couple of little verses, we don't have to go there. I've got part of it on the screen here. Hosea mentions that God will be like the dew to Israel, helping them blossom and spread out. If we look at the context in Hosea 14, it's speaking of Hosea trying to turn the people back to God and showing what will happen if they do. That, to me, is just showing the absolute goodness of God. And that's going to be extended right through here as well. We also have Moses speaking about dewness and rain as well. And this is very similar sort of language that's used here. May my teaching drop, this is God speaking, drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass, and like showers upon the herb. Again, reminiscent of what we just read here in Micah. God's going to be with the people, teaching them through this remnant, sustaining them, helping them through. We then get this second scenario, and it's basically the complete opposite. So again, we have this remnant among the nations, but they're going to be like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, which when it goes through, treads down and tears in pieces, and there is none to deliver. Your hand shall be lifted up over your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. So they're going to be like lions, absolutely devouring, tearing into pieces, as it said, offering no salvation and deliverance from those who have been caught. These enemies of God are going to be completely cut off, and how opposite that is. And we've seen that throughout this chapter and the previous chapter. No one's going to be able to stand up to God. When Jesus comes, when Jesus fights that battle, no one's going to be able to stand up to it at all. The rest of chapter 5 looks at what I've called there purging the land. And again, might get sort of an idea of, okay, purge isn't generally that good, but it is going to be good. It's going to be able to refreshen the land and bring it back to its glory. Going through all kinds of objects or ideas here that they have to get out. It's packed full of lessons for what we could perhaps purge our bodies of, obviously using the symbolism here and not the literal sense of the words. God's going to cut off the horses and he's going to destroy the chariots. We read that in verse 10. Remembering, of course, that we're using this symbolism, God's just going to remove this military might that people have, and in particular, the self-reliance that it brings. So we discussed at length last class about how the kingdom, anything military-related, is just going to be gone. We're not going to be fighting anyone. No one's going to have weapons. We're not even going to learn about it anymore. For Israel in particular, and throughout their history, they have tendencies of being self-reliant rather than relying on God. Back in Deuteronomy 17, God specifically mentions about not relying on horses. We have the story of Deborah and Barak from Judges, where the opposing Canaanite army had horses, they had chariots, and they got stuck in the mud. They were rendered absolutely useless through God. Psalm 20, verse 7 reads, "Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God." Some amazingly wise words. coincidentally as well, at least, when I was looking through the story of Deborah and Barak, I have a study Bible if you weren't aware, and one of the notes that it put was that a chariot is like the modern day tank, and it was rendered absolutely useless then, and it's going to be absolutely useless when Christ eventually comes. All of that modern technology just gone. We've got cities and strongholds, verse 11, and I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds. Again, we have similar thoughts here of that self-reliance. You set yourself up in a nice palace with these big walls. You don't really worry about what's going to be on the other side because they can't get through. You're not relying on God, you're relying on yourself at that particular point. When the Babylonians invaded, Jerusalem's high walls were no match. They were able to just breach through, and it was only God's intervention and Hezekiah's reliance on God that kept Jerusalem out of Assyrian hands. So we see how much we need to be relying on God rather than whatever man can come up with, whatever we think that we can do ourselves. It's all through God. So hopefully you're starting to perhaps see a bit of a trend as to what's going on. Sorcery and fortune telling are going to be completely removed. Now, I don't think that's anything we necessarily do here, perhaps sort of specifically. But again, we don't need to be seeking help from other people, seeking help perhaps from the dead or from mysterious places. And again, this is something that Deuteronomy specifically mentioned that was forbidden. And yet it snuck its way in, and eventually became the norm within Israel. And so it's eventually going to be completely gone rid of when Christ returns. We have false gods and idols, as verse 13 through to 14 mentions about. Because, surprise, surprise, there's only one God to follow, and we need to be reliant on him. So obviously today we have other gods, we have other religions, they'll be done away with. But even outside of religion, there are idols that we can worship and bow down to, things that men have made. Maybe it's sports or video games or movies or music or a whole host of various things. If it's taking time away from God, then it's starting to become an idol, and we need to be wary of that. I'm certainly not perfect in those sort of things. I know that there are times when those things have taken my attention away from God. It's something that we have to be aware of and try and combat. So what's going to happen then? We get down to this last verse here in verse 15. And in anger and wrath I will execute vengeance on the nations that did not obey. So this is God's righteous anger on those who aren't obeying his words and aren't destroying what he's already told them. They're still trying to be self-reliant. They're not relying on God. And there's also a bit of a difference here between here and verses 1 and 2 of chapter 4. In verses 1 to 2 of chapter 4, it talks about those that will listen and those that will want to go and worship and follow after God, going up into the mountain of the Lord. And then we have here those who are going to disobey and refuse to follow God for whatever reason that they have. And they're going to die. So they're the main, if you remember last class, I mentioned that I was mainly going to be looking at these three couple of chapters. And I was just intending to sort of stop, but I couldn't help it because there are some other amazing verses that I want to look at. We won't necessarily look at it too much, but in chapter 6, and at verse 6, we have these three amazing verses, that I'll just quickly read out that then lead on to what I want to finish on. So Micah 6, verse 6. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. So we see these ideas of justice. We brought that out very strongly last class, that that was something that wasn't the norm in Israel at that time. It's not the norm now. People generally aren't just. But here we have three, I mean, they're simple words. They're very hard to live up to. To do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. And that ties in with what is, I've already talked about this verse, I think, a couple of times in Exhorts, one of my favourite sections, and that's right at the end of chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 18 to 20, has, to me, some of the most uplifting and encouraging words, and I wanted to end on these words and just a bit of a thought, because that all links everything together. So verse 18 of Micah 7. Who is a God like you, pardoning iniquity and passing over transgression for the remnant of his inheritance? He does not retain his anger forever, because he delights in steadfast love. He will again have compassion on us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. You will cast all our sins into the depths of the sea. You will show faithfulness to Jacob and steadfast love to Abraham, as you have sworn to our fathers from the days of old. So just a couple of points that I really wanted to bring out. We've got a never-changing God, a God who pardons iniquity and pardons transgression. It's the same God that revealed himself to Moses all those many years ago. It's the same God here in Micah. And it's the same God now, merciful and forgiving for us. And Ben touched on this as well in his exhort about the forgiveness that we need to then extend to our own brothers and sisters. If God's offering this to us, we need to offer it out as well. He will again have compassion on us. And I want to highlight that word again. It's not a one-time deal. It's not a limited offer. It's again and again if we need it, if we come to him with repentance. And then what's he going to do with all of this? He's going to tread out our iniquities. So we saw this idea of treading earlier with the threshing floor, absolutely crushing it, and how devastating it would be for the nations who experience this from Israel. Here it's the same. It's going to be completely stamped on. It's going to fly away like chaff, if we're using that threshing floor analogy. Not only that, but all our sins are going to be tossed into the ocean, into the depths of the sea. Once it's tossed there, it's gone. All of this forgiveness eventually leads us into that miraculous kingdom that's going to come through God's grace and through God's mercy. So what does this all mean for us in wrapping up here? What can we get from Micah with these kingdom prophecies? I saw two major points that I want you guys to take away. Hopefully it's not too onerous. We've seen that God gives the victory. It's God alone who does this. It's not through our own strength. It's not through our own might or our own wisdom. It's God. And that victory, whether it's now or whether it's later, is going to be so much better than what the world can offer. And the second one that we've seen is this danger of sin and of self-reliance and what that will bring to the people when Christ eventually returns. We need to be on guard. We need to watch so that it doesn't come in, creep in and affect us. So thank you, everyone, for coming out. This book, to me, it's quite exceptional. There's so many different points that I didn't even get to touch on. Don't get any ideas, but you could do another couple of classes on Micah easily. And even some of the other smaller books, they're just jam-packed full of amazing things that show us an amazing future, and a future that hopefully we pray and hope we'll be a part of as well.